it's Extinction for All. And one for Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide. Because the world's so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you go freaking nuts. Very special guest is Randall Carlson from sacredgeometryinternational.info. And where we left off, you were talking about the alleged fraud of the sixth great mass extinction, were you?
Well, I didn't use the word fraud, but, you know, I think
that's why I used the word alleged.
Oh, okay. Well, I think what's important is that we place it into context. And when we talk about mass extinctions, they say the sixth great mass extinction is referring to there are previously five great mass extinctions. And, of course, the worst was the Permian-Triassic extinction of 245 million years ago, followed by an extinction in the Ordovician period, another one in at the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary, which is probably the most famous, which is the 65-million-year-ago event where actually closer to 66 million were the dinosaurs and the great ammonites and things. It was a global extinction episode in which roughly 75% of all species disappeared in a very short period of time in terms of geological time. And when we talk about now we're in the middle of the sixth great mass extinction, the assumption is that what's going on now is comparable in severity and magnitude to the previous five. Now, I should say that the most famous one, the Cretaceous-Tertiary mass extinction, is generally considered the third within the lineup of severity. So right in the middle, right? Now, as it stands now, you know, there are a lot of assumptions about how many species are going extinct, but it's not really based on actual species counts. It's based upon assumptions of how many unknown species there are living in, how many hectares of habitat that are potentially or theoretically destroyed each year. And so it's a completely hypothetical number based upon computer models. It's not actually based upon any counting of actual species mortality. If you don't count island extinctions, and certainly, you know, New Zealand is generally included in the anthropogenic extinction models because, you know, you had the giant flightless moa birds there, and the blame for their extinction is usually placed upon the arrival of the Maori people some 800 years ago. Because there's associated with the geological horizon at which the moas disappear, there's also abundant charcoal. Now, charcoal is usually attributed to fires, human-induced fires. Well, though if you actually talk to the Maori people themselves, they're not going to accept blame for the extinction of the moa birds. They basically have legends about fire coming from the sky. And I actually am more inclined personally to believe the traditions of the Maori rather than the archaeologists or the paleontologists or the zoologists, that because they see this layer of charcoal, they assume that essentially the Maoris arrived, hunted all the moa birds to extinction in overnight and set fire to all the vegetation of the island for whatever reason. Just doesn't make sense. Just doesn't make sense.
And if anybody's ever been out in the New Zealand bush lighting a single fire in any way, shape, or form, trying to find enough dry stuff to get that is freaking impossible.
I'm glad to hear that straight from the mouth of an indigenous person there, right? Because that's what I had sort of guessed, actually, to be the case.
Let's burn down the rainforest. Brilliant idea. Brilliant.
Yeah. Let's completely, you know, sabotage our own possibility of any kind of economic future at all here. We'll just destroy the whole infrastructure of our society just for the...
When the settlers came in, they did do a heck of a lot of burning to clear farmland.
Yes. I'm apparently aware of. And the question is, can we then now extrapolate backwards and assume that the arrival of the Maori people 800 years ago did the same thing? I think they were primarily hunters rather than farmers. So I don't know if they had any incentive to clear lots and lots of farmland. But in any case, going from, you know, New Zealand to, you know, other island extinctions like Madagascar, for example, it's generally assumed without any real hard empirical evidence that it was the arrival of humans. We see that the last mass extinction in Earth history, which was at the end of the Pleistocene, 13,000 years ago, when all of the megafauna disappeared. Now, of course, you had a tremendous bestiary of megafauna in Australia that went extinct about 20,000 years earlier than the megafauna in the rest of the world that went extinct. And this is, it sometimes has been blamed on the arrival of the Aboriginal peoples, which, again, I don't believe, because Aboriginal peoples have their own traditions about what caused the extinction of the Australian megafauna. And again, I, without going into the details on it, I strongly suspect and believe that it was a natural catastrophic episode rather than anything that the humans did. Humans had a role in it. It may have been only finishing off surviving species in the aftermath of a catastrophe. Likewise, you know, in the northern hemisphere, there was about 120 species of mega mammals that went extinct at the end of the last ice age. You know, you probably, you know that there were woolly mammoths. You know, North America here, we had more elephants in North America than Africa does now. And that's kind of bizarre when you think about it. There were mastodons and four different species of woolly mammoths. So it's actually five species of proboscideans in North America prior to the end of the last ice age. There were giant ground sloths, there were giant cave bears, there were saber-toothed cats, there were beavers that weighed 500-600 pounds. The list went on and on and on and on, about 120, 125 species. Well, come between 11 and 13,000 years ago, all of those species went extinct. Woolly mammoths went extinct over the entire globe. Mastodons did as well. Mastodons ranged all the way into South America. They went extinct. The tendency has
I have a different theory.
What is your theory,
Ben? I believe that the woolly mammoths and the incredibly slow sloths bred together and evolved into the modern obese American culture.
Well, you know, you may have something there. You know, I basically look at the present incarnation of our government, and the nearest creature that I can liken to describe by analogy what our present government has evolved into is Jabba the Hutt from the old Star Wars. And, you know, perhaps when a creature like that becomes so slothful it can no longer move, you know, things change. It can't adapt. I definitely think there's analogies here between what goes on in nature and what goes on in society.
People think that society is detached from nature because we're not living in the bush or something. You know, we're not natural creatures or something like that. But the same thing that affects the world and all the creatures in it affects us too. And why wouldn't we follow the same patterns?
Of course it does. And, of course, we have built our advanced industrial society when in an interval of relatively calm climate and environmental change. And see, there's my point here that I'm trying to make is we can't take anything for granted. And I was trying, I guess, getting back to the question here, which we're kind of digressing from somewhat, but still it pertains to the question of this sixth grade mass extinction. So my point is that if we actually count the number of species, not counting the species that have disappeared on islands, because I think that's questionable. I don't think we can just, without any further critical thought, blame all that on humans, the arrival of humans, every time we see an island extinction. But if we actually count the number of species that we know of that have gone extinct as a result of our activities, it's probably only about a dozen species. You know, a lot of the species...
Can I ask, is this part of the environmental movement as well to demonize man as a cancer on the planet by blaming us for everything that happens?
By blaming us for everything, absolutely, absolutely. And like I said before, it has its roots within, you know, the prevailing paradigm at the time that the environmental movement began in the late 60s and early 70s was strictly gradualistic. See, nobody back then was thinking about the fact that, you know, maybe every few thousand years the planet might get struck by an asteroid or, you know, a gigantic volcanic eruption that spews, you know, 500 cubic kilometers of ash into the atmosphere. People just weren't thinking along those lines. They were basically thinking that the history of the Earth had been generally pretty quiet, calm, peaceful, gradual, uniform, until humans came along to upset the balance of nature, see? And that paradigm still dominates environmentalist thinking. And I have conversations all the time with them. I read a lot of them. I still, in my own way, think of myself as an environmentalist. But I'm now realizing and have realized for 20-some years now that there are factors, much bigger players in the environmental stability of this planet than what anything we humans have yet contributed to it. And let me put this into perspective. We talk about the sixth great mass extinction. We'll take the middle one, the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary extinction of 65 million years ago. We know that the Earth got struck by at least one asteroid. I mean, that's unequivocally demonstrated. The asteroid has struck the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico. It left a crater 150 to 180 miles in diameter. The object was about 6 miles in diameter. It was probably moving 25 to 30,000 miles per hour when it hit. When an object like that strikes the Earth, that in that particular case, it released explosive energy equivalent to a couple of 100 million megatons. Now, to put that in perspective, think about it. The height of the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union, late 60s, early 70s, the total nuclear arsenals of both sides was between 10 and 12,000 megatons. I'll say that again. Between 10 and 12,000 megatons, right? Now, imagine what kind of environmental havoc and social havoc would have been wrought had we engaged in an all-out thermonuclear war back then. Imagine that we unleashed all of the thousands of nuclear warheads on both sides, raining down on the cities, creating, thousands of nuclear explosions. The total amount of energy released into the global environment would have been, in round numbers, about 10,000 megatons. The asteroid that struck the Yucatan Peninsula released energy on the order of 200 million megatons. Think about that. Okay, now, when that happened, you had most of the vegetation on planet Earth burned up. You had seismic events all over the planet that were perhaps measured in 10 to 11 on the Richter scale. You had outpouring of tremendous amounts, tens of thousands of cubic miles of basaltic lava in India, the Deccan Traps, which released huge, huge amounts of sulfur into the atmosphere, poisoning the atmosphere. It's likely, according to some studies, that for a while the rainfall that was happening globally may have had the pH of acid, a battery acid. You would have had the skies darkened for years. Now, you think about that, and there's now evidence that possibly there was a second great impact into the Indian Ocean. Indian geologists have discovered a huge crater, even bigger than the one that's in the Yucatan, that appears to be on the bottom of the Indian Ocean, that also looks like it's dating to the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary of 66 million years ago. Plus, there were at least half a dozen smaller impacts around the globe that are also dating to that same period. Now, you think about that. Think about, a couple of 100 million megatons of energy. You're talking about on the order of 10 billion Hiroshima bombs, to try to put that in perspective. The bomb that completely obliterated Hiroshima. Think about 10 billion of those. I mean, you can't even conceive of that. Now, that was one of the five great mass extinctions that occurred. The question is, on the part of a lot of paleontologists, is really, how did anything survive the severe consequences of that event? Well, when I look out my window today, things look pretty calm and placid out there. The sun is shining. The birds are chirping. There are beautiful blue sky. Clouds are in the sky. I mean, there may be some chemtrails up there, but nonetheless, things look pretty calm, and I'm pretty confident that, tomorrow morning it's going to be another day similar to this. We may get some rainfall tomorrow, and it's going to be probably a hot summer like it always is here in the, southern America. But nonetheless, there's nothing going on out there that would be equivalent to all of the vegetation on Earth burning down. Nothing like a cosmic winter being superimposed in the aftermath of that. Nothing like, 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years of almost total darkness around the planet from all of the soot and the ash in the atmosphere. Nothing like the thousands of cubic miles of dirt and ash that's filling the atmosphere as a result of the impact itself. So when you think of it in that context, I mean, how do we say that what's going on now is comparable to an event like that? I personally think it's ludicrous.
Well, you know, again, the whole environmental movement is essentially just designed to make humanity the enemy. And as far as I know from the one of the founders of the environmental movement who went on to create Sea Shepherd, he separated from that whole green movement thing because he saw that it was being infiltrated and being taken over and becoming under the control of people who were essentially just hardcore communists. And if people are the enemy... What's the solution to that? Exterminate everybody? I think a communist dictatorship would probably be up to the task, don't you?
I think I would concur completely with that. And yes, it's true. I think that what has happened is the science of environmentalism has been replaced by the politics of environmentalism. Mm. And I don't think at this point the political environmentalists are actually doing any good for the environment at all. I mean, it's a political agenda of control. They're still laboring under this misconception that, you know, what we're doing to the Earth is something just unprecedented in its severity and its destructiveness. But they're refusing to look at, you know, the scientific data that's there now. That, you know, when I get into discussions, debates with folks quite frequently on this question, because I've been fairly public in my expressing my opinions on it, so I get challenged when I... say that, you know, global warming isn't all it's hacked up to be, you know, that, yes, there's probably an element of truth to that. I certainly believe that by adding 100 parts per million of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere would probably increase the temperature of the planet by maybe a quarter of a degree in 100 years. But I think that the, you know, basically it's been the whole question, again, has been hijacked to serve a political agenda of basically human control.
Yeah. Well, that seems to be the it's the story of the 20th century, and if you look back, it's the story of human existence. Somebody's always trying to hijack and use a crisis for their own ends. We'll be right back after the break. Oh yeah! Welcome back. Welcome, everybody, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Randall Carlson from SacredGeometryInternational.info. Now, we were talking about the climate change movement on the time, and if you want to see a video of us having a bit of an altercation with what I've come to call climate cultists, you can go to my YouTube channel, Mr. News Guerrilla Media, and just Google and just have a look through the videos for climate change. We've done a lot of work exposing the fraud and the scumbaggery inherent in that. But the one particular one where we actually kind of practically get assaulted by these people is called, I think, Climate Change Death Cult Morons. I wanted to have something that was neutral, you know, and not overly offensive as a title. So anyway, Randall, welcome back.
I'm still here.
Okay, cool.
I didn't run off in a panic.
Thank goodness.
I'm always playing hardball here.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, my God, the climate's changing. You mean, right.
Well, here's the thing.
I remember somebody asked me one time, actually, oh, you don't believe that climate change is real? No, I believe it's real. It's been happening for 4 billion years.
Yeah, exactly. here's what's happened. The debate has been hijacked. When the climate seems to have leveled off 10 years ago and not really warmed since then, according to all of the temperature monitoring stations, they basically changed the term. They moved the goalpost by saying, well, we won't refer to it as global warming anymore. We'll refer to it as climate change. And then anybody who questioned the dogma of global warming was then labeled a climate change denier. And, you know, in reading through the literature of climate change by the wide variety of climate-related sciences, of which there are, you know, hundreds, I actually have several thousand articles in my archives going back decades and decades, I couldn't produce one single quote-unquote climate scientist or scientist in a related field who didn't believe that the climate was changing. Of course the climate is changing. It's always been changing.
And yeah, I got called a climate denier once, and I said, no, I'm not. I never denied there was a climate.
Yeah, you know, you did. Yeah. Last time I looked out my window, there was a climate out there.
I mean, bro.
Now, you know, and see, here's the thing. That's not to say that, you know, we should just proceed with utter impunity to, you know, the way we conduct our affairs in the natural world. Of course not. But to me,
but what these people are doing, Randall, is they're ignoring all the real environmental issues in favor of one that gives them a political agenda to create a world government. I mean, that's basically the crux of the issue here for me, is that they ignore mercury, they ignore fluoride, they ignore pesticides. I mean, look, the amount of cancer that people are already getting in around what? 1 in 3, 1 in 2 in New Zealand, mm-hmm. and people get cancer, okay? Environmentalists aren't talking about any of the causality factors with that within our food or anything. They're like, no. The only important thing is this climate change thing that's been completely made up and fraudulated.
Well, I'm afraid you hit the nail on the head, is because, you know, when you go back to the 70s, the concern was global cooling. And you know, if you actually look at the temperature, the average global temperature, what you see is that we were in a period called the Little Ice Age by climate scientists, which was the coldest period since the end of the Great Ice Age 10,000 years ago. And if you actually look at glaciers' response to this cooling of the global climate, you'll see that they grew worldwide to the largest extent they had been in 10,000 years. So when we are now looking at glacier recession, we have to recognize that we're looking at their recession from the largest they have grown in 10,000 years. And there's now evidence in hand that the glaciers have repeatedly almost disappeared and then returned again. And you have to understand that when you start talking about glacier recession, this is a process that began over a century and a half ago. You know, and if you look at the amount of CO2 that humans are dumping into the atmosphere, prior to World War II, it was insignificant. Not enough to where any climate scientist would argue that we were having a significant effect on the global temperature. It was during World War II and the post Second World War, with the you know, growth of car culture and so forth, that we began dumping 4, 5, and 6 billion tons roughly of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere every year. Bear in mind, of course, though, that cycling through the atmosphere naturally is over about 750 billion cubic tons. So we're only adding a small percentage to that, which is naturally cycling through the atmosphere. But in any case, the global warming began in the middle of the 1800s, and it's just basically been continuing on with some interruptions. The last interruption was roughly between the 1940s and the 1970s. The first half of the 20th century saw a pretty significant climate rise globally of about a half a degree. Most of that has to be based upon natural phenomena because, again, we weren't doing enough to significantly change the global climate. Then what happened is with the advent of radiocarbon dating in the 1950s, the 1960s, it became apparent that interglacial oscillations were occurring much more frequently and much more rapidly than anybody had previously realized. And it also, as I mentioned earlier, became apparent by that time that the longest interglacial interval of the last roughly 250,000 years was the one we're in now. Okay, so the immediate implication of that is that, well, our own interglacial period of interglacial warmth might be coming to an end. Well, at the same time that realization set in, we actually went into a period of more or less global cooling. Between the 1940s, the mid-1940s, and the mid-1970s, the temperature of the planet on average cooled slightly. What's interesting about that is exactly when we started pumping significant amounts of CO2 into the atmosphere, what was any response of the atmosphere? Was to cool off rather than to warm up. Well, then come the 80s, we went through a two-decade interval of climatic warming. Well, you can almost understand why scientists would have assumed that, you know, maybe we're headed for global cooling back in the 70s because, number one, we were what appeared to be at the end of an interglacial epoch. And two, the climate actually was cooling. The interesting thing, though, is that it was going to be impossible, difficult if not impossible, to blame global cooling on human activity. Nobody was thinking in the 70s that this cooling that we were seeing around the world was caused by humans. The assumption was that it was completely natural. With the advent of global warming, though, global warming had the distinct advantage of being able to be attributed to human activity. And so it became a crusade for the environmental movement. Oh, we're changing the temperature of the planet that's going to overheat. We're all going to die from all of these, you know, the vicious hurricanes that are going to be unleashed and the droughts that are going to be unleashed and all of the bad consequences and so forth. And so, you know, you've basically got a whole movement now that's entrenched into this political paradigm, and they don't want to let go of that because they're not really looking at the science. Again, they cherry-pick the science to support their preconceived concept that humans are destroying the global environment and that we are going to provoke a climate catastrophe. And a term that you often hear proffered in the circles is the tipping point. By, you know, adding another 10 parts per million of a natural trace gas, CO2, to the atmosphere, the whole planet's going to spin into this terrible, you know, global catastrophe. Well, what I like to say in response to that, Vinny, is this. Okay, I think that a real tipping point is not really another 10 or 20 parts per million of CO2 added to the atmosphere. A real tipping point is, say, like when a mile-wide asteroid slams into the Earth moving at 30,000 miles per hour. That's a tipping point. A tipping point might be when you have a super volcanic eruption spewing 500 cubic kilometers of ash and dust into the global atmosphere, causing the entire planet to go dark for 2 or 3 years. That's a tipping point. Another 10 parts per million of CO2? No, I'm sorry, I can't quite accept that as being, quote-unquote, a tipping point.
Yeah, that's like a faucet. It's like a dripping point, you know, rather than a tipping point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And another thing they don't want to talk about, the fact that three to four times as many people die when the weather gets cold than when it gets hot. Or that a global cooling, if you look at history, the global cooling episodes have always been far more detrimental than global warming periods. You know, if you look back at the Dark Ages, the Dark Ages, which began in the mid-6th century, was a period of global cooling and literal global darkness, probably attributed possibly to volcanic eruptions. One theory that's been presented that actually is plausible to me is that we had a dusting. The planet got dusted by cosmic debris, probably disintegrating comet. There's actually been a crater discovered in the off the coast of Norway that's been called Grendel that appears to date right from the historically attributed date for the onset of the Dark Age, about 540 AD. Anyways, there was a global cooling, and one of the consequences of that global cooling episode is that agriculture collapsed for several years between 536 and 540 AD, and as a consequence of that, people became malnourished. Because people got malnourished, their immune systems got weakened. And then in 542, we had the onset of the Justinian Plague, which wiped out millions of people worldwide. Then come again around the early 1300s, we had the Bubonic Plague, which again came on the heels of the first phase of cooling of the Little Ice Age, when it came on. If you look at the period from about 950 AD to roughly 1250 AD, this was the medieval warm period. And this is when, Scandinavians were colonizing the west coast of Greenland, where it's now perennial permafrost. You know, when they had a flourishing wine industry in England, you know, where you can't really grow wine grapes now without lots of extra intervention. A lot of indications that the global temperature might have been up to a degree warmer during the medieval warm period. And if you look at that period, what you had was, you had an expansion of human lifespan. You had an enormous expansion of human population. You had a longer growing season, so people had more to eat. And then you had society flourished, moved forward, advanced, and evolved. Then come about the middle 12th century, you had the onset of the great Gothic Age building boom, when they built all the great cathedrals, only because they had such amounts of surplus food to eat that they could create... you know, that they could support these armies of artisans and stonemasons and glaziers and engineers and carpenters to build these tremendous cathedrals. They couldn't have done anything like that during the cold of the Dark Ages. And when the cold of the Little Ice Age came on, all of that great wave of building and activity came to an end. And again, you had multiple years where you had collapses of global agriculture, and in the wake of that, you had famine. In the wake of the famine, you then had disease and pestilence and bubonic plague. These are the consequences of global cooling. The consequences of global warming is social advancement, flourishing of human society, you know, decrease in infant mortality, increase in lifespan. Not to say that there isn't a downside, because there's always a downside to any change at all. But, you know, the climate is not going to stand still. Despite the fantasies of the climate change environmentalists, the climate of the planet is not going to stabilize. It's some norm, because there is no norm. You know, when you think about the oscillations between glacial and interglacial ages, where in there is the norm? If you actually look at the last 2.5 million years, 3/4 of the time or more, we've been in the grip of an ice age. That has been the norm for the last 2.5 million years. If you go back the last 10 million years, back into the Pliocene and the Miocene, you have global warmth, much warmer than now. You have sea levels up 10, 20, 40 feet higher than now. So, I mean, who's going to define what's norm? What, you know, 1950?
You know what I reckon is going to happen? You know what I reckon is going to happen? We're going to have the ability to control the weather and the ability to manipulate and mold the weather how we want, and they're going to call it the Pleistocene era.
The Pleistocene era?
Yeah. Because Pleistocene can be molded and shaped.
I understand. I understand. That's perhaps you're right. But in any
and
case,
what's happening right now, we've got the chemtrail activity and things of that nature. Like, have you noticed reports around the world of very strange weather events, like snow falling when the temperature is well above freezing temperature? Like, there's no physical possibility, really, that it could actually turn into snow without some kind of outside influence.
I haven't really looked into that. I mean, I have definitely looked into, episodes of unusual weather. I mean, that's one of the things when I study climate change. I mean, that's one of the things that I look at. And of course, you know, when you start looking at some of the weather events throughout history, there have been some really bizarre, extreme weather events, you know. So it's not like what's going on now is so extreme that it's totally unprecedented. There have been some amazing hurricanes and droughts and tornadoes and things throughout the history of you know, the planet, that, and even in the last few hundred years, that, you know, that really show that, to me, you know, there's always been these anomalies that are inexplicable. I don't know if what's going on is any different now than what it has been. But I have actually, I've created a couple of multimedia shows just about the subject of climate change from all angles. And one of the things that I've documented extensively in these climate change presentations is anomalous weather through the last couple of centuries. Anomalous weather, like up to the 1940s, 1950s, because of the fact that prior to that time, you know, you couldn't really blame it on humans. And I don't think any humans were trying to blame it on, you know, the activities of mankind. They fully accepted that some of these bizarre climate incidences were, in fact, totally natural.
Mm. So. Well, let's talk about this after the break as well. In fact, we've gone well off sacred geometry. We've been talking about climate change for practically an hour. So I think we'll leave that, put a pin in it, and we'll come back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Randall Carlson, Sacred Geometry International.info. Ladies and gentlemen, back in a minute. Welcome back, everybody, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week. I do very much hope that everybody appreciates the work that we do here at American Freedom Radio. And just remember, of course, there is a massive economic crisis going on in the truther community on a constant basis. So if anybody is capable of shelling out $5 of some description, go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com and click the donate button. And if you don't like me specifically, and of which I could totally understand, go to AmericanFreedomRadio.com and click on the donate banner there and give them $5. And it all makes the world go round. Thank you very much for all your contributions as well. It would be nice if we could get some new subscribers to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. I hit up to about 80 of them before PayPal cancelled my account and left me with nothing. And that took me like 3 years to get up. So if you're listening to this broadcast, please, please subscribe and make a regular donation to the Vinnie Eastwood Show just to keep us going as we are. My very special guest, Randall Carlson from Sacred Geometry International, either .com or .info, it matters not. Goes to the same place anyway. So, Randall, you've been around for quite a number of years, and I've been having conversations with my guitarist, Mikhail, about this, about the one of the best decades to ever exist, the 70s. The reason why the 70s is one of the best decades is because it's the only decade I've ever heard of for which any activity or any kind of things that you do during that decade are excused by the fact that it was that decade. You know, oh man, I took a lot of acid, but hey, it was the 70s. Hey man, we traded wives and things like that and had wild orgies and stuff, but hey, it was the 70s. Yeah. Any kind of support, humor or anything can be completely explained away instantly by simply saying that it was the 70s. I love that.
Yeah, well, it was quite a time to be certainly in my 20s and being single. I'll say that, yes, the 70s, I did a lot of things that I don't do anymore, to say the least.
I knew it.
But I had a good time doing it. Luckily, they got over. You know, it's a good thing that the 70s didn't last for 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, I know. You could imagine the kind of shape our society would be in now. But no, wait, it's actually already in pretty bad shape, isn't it?
Well, though, you know, in some ways, respects, though, it's interesting because it was a time of relative freedom, at least in America. You know, there was an interval. You know, I think after Nixon got discredited, he kind of, once he got hounded out of office, he took a lot of that police state, command and control, authoritarian mentality with him. And, you know, the Vietnam War was ended, and, you know, I think people just said, hey, you know, let's party. And there was a degree of relative freedom and, of course, a lot of hedonism. But in most of the folks that I know who are in the middle of that, you know, sort of, you know, eventually outgrew it, or they, you know, or they didn't last. But then there was a time there during the 70s where, you know, I think it was kind of, for me, it was like the last burst of freedom in America before the onset of authoritarianism came along again in the 80s. And we had the drug war and, you know, no-knock warrants and all of the things that went along with that. And, you know, and it's just progressively gotten worse since then. And it's just too bad because there's a whole generation of Americans now that kind of have forgotten what freedom actually tastes like. Because they've grown up, you know, in the last 20 years where basically the government has been the dominant factor. See, when I was a kid in the 50s, you know, there was still a considerable amount of autonomy amongst people as a rule. Just in my profession, for example, you know, my father built 200 houses without ever getting permission from anybody. You know, now I have to go through a long, convoluted process of, you know, bureaucratic minefields in order to get a permit to do a project, you know. You know, and that's just, you know, one example. I mean, there are thousands of examples of how we're losing our freedom on a daily basis. And, you know, I'm one of those who believes that, you know, freedom is second only to life itself in terms of its preciousness and its value. And I certainly do want to see us get back to the idea that, hey, you know what, leave people alone and for the most part people will do all right. I like to say, you know, if you have a different... If you want something different from the state than what I want, then you have an agenda. And what do I want from the state? I really don't want anything from the government other than the right to be left alone. And I'll take care of myself, my family, my friends, my local community, my business, and we'll do just fine. But that was once the ideal of America, and that has been pretty much, for the most part, completely lost. Till we had the rise of, you know, sort of an alternative, you know, back in 2008 with the running of Ron Paul, who was basically trying to, you know, educate people about, hey, wait a second, you know, you've kind of lost your way here. We're descending rapidly into totalitarianism here. And it's time to take a time out and you know, ask about, you know, which road do we want to go down from here? And I think a lot of people got hoodwinked in the last two elections, thinking that there was going to be some significant change that occurred in America, and it hasn't happened, other than just a further erosion of our freedom and our autonomy as individuals and as local communities and so forth. So that doesn't really much have much to do, I think, with St. Geometry, but it's an important part of where we need to go from here. I think that, you know, sacred geometry is a way of reconnecting with our past. You know, we learned that there were ways that our predecessors on the planet discovered ways that they could introduce a little bit greater degree of harmony into their daily lives. And if nothing else, that's what sacred geometry gives us, is the ability to introduce an element of harmony. Because, you know, what the Hermetic dictum is, as above, so below. You've heard that, the old alchemical. Well, I mean, they were practicing this in a literal sense by creating an infrastructure down here below that reflected the heavens above. And certainly as somebody who grew up in a rural country environment, you know, I was much more aware of the night sky. You know, I was very fascinated in early age with astronomy for the simple reason that I could walk out my front door and there was the stars brilliant in the sky because I lived in a rural environment. And then, of course, living in Minnesota, the change of the seasons was quite pronounced and always extremely fascinating to you know, participate in this changing of the seasons, the cyclical changing through the course of the year. Was always just almost entrancing to me to experience that firsthand. And I've noticed, you know, having lived here in the urban area of near Atlanta, Georgia, which is a very large, sprawling urban area, and lots of young people who have no experience outside of that the urban experience, growing up in the city, you know, basically going into the government schools, government, you know, indoctrination factories, to me, is what they are. You know, there's kind of like lost touch with a very fundamental and important strata of reality, if you will. You know, in coming out of post-World War II and being part of the post-World War II baby generation, you know, I grew up where basically people had a very much live and let live attitude, you know, leave us alone and we'll take care of our own. You know, and very self-reliant. You know, that was sort of one of the, you know, people in Minnesota were hardy. They were settlers from Scandinavia, and they had very much of this kind of self-reliant attitude. And I've watched that erode, and I think that's to our detriment, because we've gotten so far off track with the things that are really significant that I think that our predecessors were onto, and realizing that, you know, that we are part of a much larger picture. And there are forces at work that would dwarf anything that we do. I mean, that, I think, is kind of the upshot of what we were talking about in the last two segments and how we could sort of bring that discussion back to this idea that there were these models of how society should evolve that, of course, have always been betrayed. I mean, that's the history of the evolution of society. But nonetheless, we can still see in there these constant efforts to establish some kind of an advance over what had existed previously. You know, the idea of democracy, the idea of republicanism in the true sense of the word, you know, the idea of individual freedom. But all of that, you know, when you look back, for example, in the Middle Ages, which I think is a very important period of history that we can learn a lot from, you know, this is when we see the last great establishment of the principles of sacred geometry in society, the building of these great abbeys and Gothic cathedrals, were pure expressions of the principles of sacred geometry. And the idea there is that there is this geometry of life, and that if we can recreate our world to harmonize or to conform to some extent with that geometry of life, that it'll create an environment in which we will be much more likely to prosper. And what's happened now in, you know, most of our urban environments is essentially you don't get a sense of harmony when you go into the modern urban environment. What you get is a sense of chaos.
I don't know. I think you get a sense of harmony, meaning you get harmed and you moan about it.
Yeah, exactly. You get harmed and you moan about it. That's exactly right. And there's so much I think we can learn from our predecessors, both from their successes and their mistakes. But as I was talking about earlier, you know, we see that period, that medieval warm period, you know, we see society really moving forward, and we see, you know, the advancement of knowledge, and we see the advancement of the human condition. And then when we look at, we see this reflected again when we go back to what
Randall.
Was referred. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, we're about to end the show here. We've only got about 10 or 20 seconds. So I apologize, but I'm going to have to cut you right off. So, ladies and gentlemen, and I definitely want to have you on the show again, by the way. But, ladies and gentlemen, if you are on Skype, just jump on that Skype right now and add me on Skype, vincent.eastwood. We're going to have an after-the-show conversation starting now.